Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
From the High Center Studios of Messiah College, in the eye of the Twitter storm that is Grantham, PA, this is the Wave Improvement Leads Home podcast, a bi-weekly discussion dedicated to American history, historical thinking, and the role of history in our everyday lives. Now, here's your host, author and award-winning historian, John Fia.
Thank you, Drew, and welcome to episode 34 of the Wave Improvement Leads Home podcast. 34 episodes. We're really getting up there. But I got a question for you today, Drew. Are you a Twitterstorian?
Well, maybe I call myself Twitterstorian adjacent.
Okay, frankly, you're going to have to explain that. Yeah.
Frankly, I don't have the following to claim the full mantle of Twitterstorian, but I do engage with that community on Twitter every once in a while, at least when I'm not rage tweeting about St. Louis Cardinals offseason acquisitions.
Do you have to have a following to be a Twitterstorian?
I mean... To brag about it on a podcast, I think you do.
Okay, that's fair enough. Twitter, as many of you know, has become a very effective way of communicating history and history-related ideas. There are historians out there with huge Twitter followers. So this morning I did some internet surfing, and I made a short list here of the most popular Twitterstorians tweeting today. So presidential historian Michael Beschloss, you might see him on TV a lot. He has 298,000 followers. Cambridge University classicist Mary Beard, 174,000 followers. Some of you are familiar with the popular historian Niall Ferguson, 140,000 followers. Another popular historian, Simon Schama, has 108,000 followers. And then, to top it all off, Lehigh University graduate student Drew Durley Hermeling checks in with a whopping 336 followers. That's not 336,000, folks. That's 336.
I was going to say, was that a typo there, John? I think you missed the K after the 336. No. In all seriousness, if you want to give to a good cause, you can always follow me at D. Durley Hermeling. Now, that I say that out loud. Maybe I'll blame my small following on a tough-to-spell last name.
That could be, Drew. So sorry about that. I couldn't resist. I had to add you to the mix. You're in good company. Beschloss, Beard, yeah. Schama, Ferguson, right? The folks at Lehigh, you guys who are listening out there, you have a legend, a celebrity in your midst. 336 followers.
Although it might be much easier to gain followers if I had one of those three-letter last names like Fia.
That's right.
That being said, your Twitter game's not so shabby yourself.
You know, I have over 14,000 followers. But, you know, in some ways, I think it's always a little unfair because I'm not one of those celebrities that, like, you know, have 14,000 followers and they're just following, like, two people. I follow a lot of people. And one of the reasons I follow so many people is because I love just sort of scrolling through my Twitter feed to find ideas for the blog. You know, a lot of people post some very interesting links and so forth. But my Twitter game actually pales in comparison to our guest today, Princeton University American historian Kevin Cruz.
How many followers does he have?
I'm glad you asked, Drew. I checked his feed this morning, and he has over 84,000 followers.
Pretty impressive. I mean, it's no 336, but it's pretty impressive.
Right. Yeah. Yep. We're going to spend some time chatting with him today about how he uses Twitter to get his ideas across. I think you're going to find it to be a very high energy interview. You can follow Kevin at Kevin M. Cruz, and please don't confuse him with the motivational speaker, Kevin Cruz. We should ask him about that when we get him on the phone, you know, if he's ever had any mix-ups with the motivational speaker, Kevin Cruz. If you don't know what I'm talking about, just Google the name Kevin Cruz and you'll see what I mean. And they actually look alike too, but we'll get to that. Let's make sure we ask him about that. And Drew, we also have a Twitter handle at the Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast, right? Why don't you tell everyone what that is?
That's right. It's at TWOILH podcast. If you like what we do, please follow us.
And I think we need to work on our podcast Twitter game. So this morning, Drew, I checked our podcast Twitter feed, and we have under 100 followers. You know, that's even worse than you.
That's even worse you know? Than me. That's not good.
You know, of course, Twitter, follow us on Twitter, again, at TWOILH podcast. But that's just one way, Twitter, in which you can connect with this podcast. Drew, why don't you tell us some other ways that our listeners can connect with the podcast?
Well, the Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast is a proud member of the Recorded History Podcast Network. So you can head to recordedhistory.net to check out some of our fellow network podcasts. I've been especially into Dig. Now, I mean, this is how they describe themselves, so I'm not editorializing here. They're four brilliant women historians digging up history stories on highly relevant contemporary subjects, all with a very accessible presentation. So if you want to check them out, and I highly recommend it, it's one that I've added to my Twitter feed, and I enjoy whenever their episodes drop. You can find out more about them at digpodcast.org.
Yeah, shout out there to Dig. They're doing some really good podcasting work.
Our podcast is also brought to you through the generous donations of Lisa DeGuardi, Ron Schooler, Kate Logan, Gretchen Adams. We also have a new donor to add, Judy Uhland, who is connected to us through our episode with the Boston Trinity Academy. She's a teacher there, and so that's a really great sign of support from someone who we've engaged with through the podcast.
Welcome aboard, Judy. Glad to have you on the Way of Improvement Leads Home team.
And as always, many thanks to Jennings College Consulting, discovering the right college fit for your future. If you want to become a sponsor or supporter of the show, please head over to thewayofimprovement.com and click support. And again, the best way to spread the word about the podcast is to take it to social media. So just in case you missed it, follow us at TWOILH podcast on Twitter, and you can follow us on Facebook as well. And consider giving us a positive review on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And as always, I want to give a shout out to all of those patrons out there who have contributed to our podcast. We can't do it without you. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much for your support. And we hope to be getting you some more content and things for patrons only somewhere down the road. So stay tuned.
We will join Kevin Cruz shortly, but first, you have some words for us, John.
In June 2017, President Donald Trump decided to withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Accord, a coalition of nations committed to mitigating global warming. Trump's decision was the impetus for a stimulating Twitter exchange between Joyce Chaplin, the James Duncan Phillips Chair of Early American History at Harvard, and Ted Cruz, the junior United States Senator from Texas. Chaplin opposed Trump's decision to pull the United States out of the Paris agreements. On June 1, 2017, she tweeted, quote, "The USA, created by international community in Treaty of Paris in 1783, betrays international community by withdrawing from hashtag Paris Climate Agreement today," unquote. Cruz, who was horrified by the idea that the international community created the United States, responded to Chaplin with a passion-filled tweet of his own, quote, "Just sad. Tenured chair at Harvard doesn't seem to know how USA was created. Not a treaty. Declaration plus Revolutionary War plus Constitution equals USA." He followed this with another tweet, quote, "Lefty academics at my alma mater think USA was created by international community. No, USA created by force, the blood of patriots, and we the people," unquote. Academic historians, the so-called Twitter historians rushed to their phones and keyboards to defend Chaplin. Cruz supporters and other political conservatives also took to Twitter to wage another battle in their culture war against the so-called liberal elites. We should not make too much of the Chaplin-Cruz Twitter exchange, but the quick response to this debate from American historians shed light on the role that Twitter now plays in the practice of academic history and our public discourse on matters related to the nation's past. Every major historical organization in the country is present on Twitter. History conference goers, especially those who attend larger gatherings like the annual meetings of the American Historical Association or the Organization of American Historians, use Twitter to bring order to the seemingly endless array of panels and sessions. They use hashtags such as hashtag AHA18 or hashtag OAH17 to report on content for fellow historians who are unable to be physically present. Conference programs include suggested hashtags and notes on responsible tweeting. Other historians use Twitter to provide historical context to current events. Twitter historians rose to the occasion during the 2016 presidential campaign, offering thoughts on everything from America First and Operation Wetback to Law and Order and Make America Great Again. During the presidential debates, both in the primaries and general election, historians used Twitter to correct factual errors and comment on how a candidate's reference to the past might explain their policy commitments in the present. And it was all done in real time. The history Twitter sphere is alive and well. At a time when history departments at colleges and universities around the country are struggling to enroll undergraduates in their classes and attract new majors, history on Twitter is booming. So why should historians consider joining Twitter? Here are four good reasons. First, networking opportunities. The traditional social hierarchies that we normally associate with the academic profession are less important on Twitter. Senior scholars who employ this platform in their professional lives realize that their tweets will be discussed, retweeted, and analyzed. There is thus an assumption that they are willing to enter the fray, to engage in intellectual tussles with all kinds of people. It is quite common to see exchanges and conversations on Twitter in which senior historians, junior faculty members, graduate students, undergraduate students, and history buffs all participate. Because Twitter fosters this kind of democratic conversation, it provides a wonderful venue for networking. Twitter is a great place to find participants for conference panels or build professional relationships that might result in deeper and richer conversations and collaborations in the future, including face-to-face meetings at conferences. Twitter is one of many ways for younger historians to advance their careers. Of course, scholars at all levels should take seriously the kind of tweets that they publish. People are watching. Academic reputations are on the line. One would be foolish to believe that history department committees are not checking Twitter as part of their searches for new colleagues. But nevertheless, it is a useful tool. Twitter's use of hashtags allows one to network in a more intimate subfield, specialty, or area of interest. As a historian who studies early America and American religion, I regularly check the following hashtags. Hashtag Vast Early America, which is devoted to early American history. Hashtag AmRev, the American Revolution. And hashtag AmRel, AmReL, American Religious History. Since I teach future high school history teachers, I occasionally see what people are tweeting at hashtag SSCHAT, social studies teachers, and hashtag history teacher. And my interest in how history impacts our daily lives as American citizens leads me to hashtags like hashtag why study history, hashtag everything has a history, a favorite, by the way, of our first guest on this podcast, Jim Grossman of the American Historical Association. Then there's hashtag HistoryCom for history communicators and hashtag public history. Second, Twitter is useful for crowdsourcing opportunities. I was recently finishing a book on religion and politics and realized that I wanted to say a bit more about what theologians, past and present, had written about the relationship between Christianity and political power. My deadline was fast approaching, and I needed a few standard books on the subject that I could read quickly, incorporate into my manuscript, and use to strengthen a few footnotes. Since my reading in this area was limited, I turned to Twitter. Within a few hours, I had a reading list of over 24 very good books and articles on the subject. Since I had worked hard at building a large Twitter community that included many scholars with similar interests as mine, I rarely had to think twice about the quality of the material that my followers suggested. Twitterstorians tend to be very generous people when it comes to crowdsourcing. Some want to genuinely help. Others want to show off their knowledge of the literature in this or that subfield. But whatever the motivation, scholars on Twitter can be an immense help when one is stuck on a research or writing project. Don't take advantage of them, but they can still be there to help. Those watching this kind of crowdsourcing exchange unfold on Twitter might share similar interests and thus appreciate the opportunity to strengthen their own bibliographies on the given topic. Third, platform building. Not all of us are award-winning history doyens who have publishers waiting in line for our next book. Few of us have email boxes filled with speaking invitations. Most of us don't have Ivy League degrees or built-in professional networks that we inherited from our academic advisors. Nevertheless, as historians, we take pride in our work and think that we have something useful to contribute to the historical profession or the public. Therefore, online platforms are essential. In the social media world, followers, whether they be on Twitter, Facebook, or some other site, are key to successful platform building. Twitter allows historians to express their views, share their work, and attract a community of people who find what we have to say to be useful and want to read more. In today's publishing world, trade presses and a growing number of university presses will consider a historian's online platform before offering a book contract. Most presses have limited budgets for advertising, so they expect authors and potential authors to promote their work on their social media platforms. In developing a platform, Twitter works best when combined with other forms of social media. In 2008, when my first historical monograph appeared with the University of Pennsylvania Press, someone in the press's public relations department encouraged me to create a website and a blog devoted to the book. I took this advice to heart and started The Way of Improvement Leads Home at www.theWayOfImprovement.com. This is a blog that has since expanded beyond this original book to include a variety of musings on American history, politics, religion, and academic life, and of course, even a podcast. Most of the posts, if not all of the posts, on the Way of Improvement Leads Home blog are distributed via Twitter. And then finally, fourth, Twitter helps the historian engage the public. Not all academic historians will be interested in Twitter and other social media platforms. For those of us who want to reach a non-academic audience with our work, it is indispensable. I have come to view my efforts on Twitter, and I should say my blogging, as a form of public history. Historians who use Twitter as part of their professional profile often see themselves as online curators. Many general Twitter users follow historians with academic credentials because they view us as professionals, people who they can trust. Twitter offers historians opportunities to challenge our followers to think historically about the world by sharing links to reputable websites, introducing and interpreting primary sources, suggesting pertinent books, and retweeting and commenting on news articles. Sometimes historians will unleash a series of consecutive history-related tweets in response to a current event. Many of these so-called threads are shared widely and offer a glimpse, albeit a limited one, of a historical mind in action. Every historian who practices their craft on Twitter will be quick to say that a social media platform is no replacement for the kind of long-form writing that allows us to make nuanced arguments about the past. Traditional historians who have doubts about the usefulness of social media have nothing to fear. The practice of history is not going to be reduced to 280-word sound bites anytime in the near future. But Twitter has been a boon to historians who want to build their professional profile, connect with like-minded scholars, and bring responsible history to the internet. In this sense, it is one of many tools in the historian's toolbox.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Our guest today is Kevin Cruz, professor of history at Princeton University. Cruz studies the political, social, and urban/suburban history of 20th century America. Focused on conflicts over race, rights, and religion, he has particular interests in segregation and the civil rights movement, the rise of religious nationalism, and the making of modern conservatism. His first book, White Flight, Atlanta and the Making of Modern Conservatism, 2005, won prizes including the 2007 Francis B. Simpkins Award from the Southern Historical Association and the 2007 Best Book Award in Urban Politics from the American Political Science Association. His second book, One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America, 2015, examined the rise of American religious nationalism in the mid-20th century and its legacies in American political and religious life. He's currently completing Divided We Stand, America Since the 1970s, a trade textbook with co-author Julian Zelizer, under contract with W.W. Norton.
We are thrilled today to have Princeton University historian Kevin Cruz on the program, Twitterstorian extraordinaire here. We're going to talk about Twitter today with Kevin. Kevin, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey, I just want to clarify something. We've been debating this. When you go on Twitter and you type in your name, there's also this guy out there named Kevin Cruz. He looks like he's some type of motivational business speaker or something. Are you aware of this guy?
I am deeply aware of this guy. He's a very nice man.
Have you met him?
And I say that because I know that I get all he's a very nice man. And I say that because I know I get a lot of his comments and emails that are meant for him. And I'm sure he gets a lot of the crank mail meant for me.
Okay.
And he doesn't complain about it. So but yeah, we discovered that about a couple of years ago that we both existed. And we're both, you know, white guys with brown hair in our mid-40s. So
you look
it's
alike.
Kind of funny.
You do look somewhat alike, you know, and that's what's also creepy. Yeah. So you haven't been like invited to give like a motivational talk to like the CEOs at the Marriott or anything like that?
You know? No, but no, it hasn't happened yet, but if it does happen, I will accept because apparently he gets paid like $20K per speaking engagement.
That's right.
I would be on that in a heartbeat. It would be totally disappointing, but I would do it.
So I'm glad we got this. I'm glad we got this settled. You are at, what is it? Kevin M. Cruz. Is that right?
Kevin M. Cruz. The M stands for Michael, my middle name.
Okay.
And, but we still get confused. There was an event here. On campus, about a year ago, Sean Malenta and I did a talk for Alumni Day, and the organizers said, "Okay, we've mocked up the poster. Here it is, guys. What do you think of it?" They had a photo of the other Kevin Cruz.
That's so great.
Even my own university can't pick the right photo.
Don't know who you are.
Right,
that's
right.
Funny. Yeah. So, anyway, I just wanted to you know, clarify that and make sure that we're talking to the right Kevin Cruz here.
Yeah, well, I appreciate
at least
it.
At least
so if you ever see an inspirational quote on Twitter or the internet that comes from Kevin Cruz, it's not me. I'm not inspirational at all.
That's right. Although 84,000 followers might beg to differ. But let's jump right in here, Kevin. You know, first of all, do you embrace the title Twitter historian? I mean, is that something that you're willing to accept as part of your identity, or you know?
Sure, yeah. Okay. I mean, it was the term I came very late to Twitter. It was a term that had already been invented, and there were a lot of very smart, impressive people who were using it. So I happily took that on.
Okay. At what moment did you feel you kind of became a Twitter historian? I mean, when did you realize that Twitter might be a tool in your toolbox, say, as a historian?
Well, you know, I didn't join it until February 2015, I think. Okay. And I only did so basically because the publisher for my last book, Basic Books, had a social media guy who was very intent on authors using this stuff to promote their own work. So I kind of came into it kicking and screaming. I've never had a Facebook page. I didn't have a cell phone until 2002. So I'm kind of a classic, you know, a historian Luddite. But I came to this pretty late, and I did so solely to, you know, I was told I needed to do this to promote the book, and it was good for that. But I quickly learned that if you use Twitter, and there are historians who do this and other people too, who use Twitter just as kind of their press releases.
Right.
It's really boring and it's not engaging. And so, you know, I came in a moment when, politics, which is another passion of mine, was starting to get pretty interesting. And it was really over that summer, it was really over that summer of 2015.
The summer of Trump? The summer of Trump was that?
The summer of Trump.
That's right.
But it wasn't just Trump. The real thing that drove me into really seeing the value of Twitter as not just someone who's engaged in politics, certainly the Trump campaign and the Republican debates lit that on fire for me. But to see the value of Twitter as an historian really came in the debates over Confederate memorials in the South.
Yeah.
And so that story really picked up, and I saw a lot of misinformed takes about the Civil War, about Southern heritage, about the origins of these statues, things like that. Things that I'm not an expert on in my own work, but I knew enough about that it felt like someone should be speaking up about that, and others were.
But
it was a moment that really got me kind of out of my shell.
Yeah.
Originally, my historical work on Twitter had been in a. If you look back, I'm pretty sure you'll find a lot of on this date in history.
Kind of
things. You know, this is the anniversary of this, or this happened 40 years ago, and kind of throwing out an image or a picture or a newspaper clipping, and very kind of. Kind of stayed things like History Channel engagement.
Right.
And it was the debate over Confederate memorials that I really dug deep. And I thought we're going to engage on this. I'm going to talk about this and I'm going to, I'll bring out, you know, go deep into the archives, get some good documents, some newspaper stories, really put that out there because there's a hunger for this knowledge out there.
Yeah.
And it's right here. It's on my computer. I can get on ProQuest historical documents and get the newspapers. I know where this stuff is. Let me get it out there. And there was a real audience for that that I found. And it was really gratifying.
Yeah. And you know, as I've sort of watched your sort of, you know, what do they call it, Drew? A Twitter game, right? As I've watched your Twitter game, I mean, you are gathering followers really quickly. Is that fair to say? I mean, I know people do have an appetite for this stuff.
Yeah. My own experience is my only experience. So I don't know if it was unusual or not, but it did seem to pick up. Pretty quick. And I think it was because, and again, I think this was something that has carried over from my general career, even, you know, decades before Twitter, is that I've always tried to write my work, whether it be a book, an article, an op-ed, whatever, for what an op-ed writer would tell you, you know, is a general informed audience.
Right.
So to not a field of experts. And not dumbing it down, but kind of hitting that sweet spot of people who are smart enough to be curious about something, but they don't have the answers at their fingertips.
Sure.
And so to find a way to communicate with that audience, I think was really key.
Yeah. And I think that's a fair assessment of your work too. I mean, it really does reach across the sort of popular, academic popular divide. Let's talk a little bit about your work and how that relates to Twitter. You've talked about this already. You know, you're a scholar on conservatism, conservative politics, race, suburbia. Your recent book was on evangelical religion, mostly focused on 20th century America. You know, do you think that kind of helped you develop a Twitter presence, such a massive Twitter presence, you know, simply because it's second nature for you. This is the stuff you think about all the time, these kind of political issues, you know, as I say, like a medievalist, right, on Twitter. Although, like, Mary Beard from Cambridge, you know, she's huge too. But so I don't know if that works. But, you know, how does your, you know, your scholarly interests intersect with your Twitter presence? I mean, in some senses, right, Twitter, you just said this before, any historian on Twitter needs to be somewhat of a generalist. Right. You know, you mentioned you're not a scholar of Confederate monuments, but you probably know 10 times more than, you know, the normal person. But talk a little bit about that. Talk a little bit about how your, you know, scholarly academic interests, you know, the kind of stuff that, you know, has shaped your very successful career thus far, intersects with this kind of Twitter, you know, what interests you about Twitter. Yeah.
Right. You know, well, I think absolutely my own interests and my own areas of expertise are ones that I think naturally lend themselves to kind of a general interest audience. Right. So, again, you know, I've worked on the civil rights movement and segregationist. I've worked on religious nationalism and the religious right. I've worked on modern conservatism. These are all things that people today, especially today, but in the modern era, are really interested in. So it kind of lends itself to that. So I've got a built-in advantage. I mean, again, you know, your note about Mary Beard and others like her, you don't have to be a 20th century Americanist to be an engaged historian on Twitter. It helps. And it helps in the same way that, you know, students, an undergraduate audience would probably naturally gravitate towards a 20th century U.S. history course.
Yeah.
Because it seems safe. It seems interesting. It seems more up there to speed. That's not to say that a medievalist can't pack a room. The really good ones do, right? Because they have the ability to show, to both bridge that that gap with their audience and to make that material come alive for them. Yeah. And so I think someone like Mary Beard and lots of others, they're Africanists, they're Latin Americanists.
Right.
There are a lot of great 19th and 18th century U.S. historians who are engaged on this, who specialize in slavery and the Civil War, who specialize in the Revolutionary era. Those things are alive and well for kind of general audiences today, too.
I made a mistake. I think Mary Beard is actually a classicist, not a medievalist, but I could be wrong about that. But
I think you're right. Yeah. There are medievalists though.
No, I know. Do you ever, I want to ask you later a question about sort of what your institution, Princeton, thinks about how you're tweeting. We'll get to that. But what about the academic profession? Do you ever get any, you know, is there, you know, we're talking about someone on Twitter being a generalist, right? You know, but do you ever get any pushback? Like, what is Cruz doing tweeting about this or that? You know, he's no expert on that. I mean, that's certainly something that would come from just a small sector of academia. Yeah. That, who knows? They might even be jealous, right? But do you ever get it? Have you gotten any pushback from like people, historians in the academy who are kind of like, you shouldn't be doing this or...
Nothing directly. And I think this stems from partially it's that whenever I can, I throw it to the experts.
Right.
And so
I notice you do that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. If I get a question about colonial history, I throw it to my colleague, Wendy Warren. If I get a question about the Revolutionary era, I bring in Joanne Freeman. Slavery. Yeah, yeah. There are tons of people in Civil War era. And so I'll constantly throw things out to the people who I know this stuff better than I do. I'm not there. I'm there to connect people with the right answer, not to be the one who gets credit for it somehow. That seems idiotic. So I think maybe that helps that people don't feel like I'm going out of my lane because I do all I can to bring other people in.
Right.
You know, that said, I know I've got maybe a slightly larger audience out there on Twitter than some of the other historians can currently have. So I do whatever I can to bring them into that spotlight. Right.
Yeah.
But a lot of times I may be the first one who sees something and answers something.
Sure. Sure.
I haven't gotten a direct comment about being on Twitter. There's a lot of, and maybe I'm just a little too sensitive. There seems to be a lot of kind of passive aggressive. Oh, I saw you're on Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that kind of, aren't you tweeting again? Or are you going to tweet this or that, you know, and that kind of, I get those comments a lot and it seems to be, it feels vaguely passive aggressive. And I don't know if that's a worry about, you know, kind of, you know, you're speaking too broadly or you're being out of your lane or what it is, or maybe I'm just being overly sensitive.
What about this, Kevin? What about this? And you don't have to answer it if you don't want to. What about, Well, he could have written three more books if he wasn't spending so much time on Twitter. I mean, do you ever get anything like that?
Not from historians. I get it from other people like you have a day job, right?
Yeah, right, right.
And I think what I'd say there is that for me, Twitter is what actually it's the break between the work, right? And so, right. So today I spent 6 hours in the archives, right?
Right. You tweeted about that too, I believe. Yeah,
I tweeted about that. Right. Every half hour or hour or so, whenever my back started to hurt, I'd sit down in 5 minutes and catch up on the news. Maybe throw a tweet out.
Right.
So in a lot of ways, Twitter is actually kind of, it's the coffee break, right? That helps me keep on going. And I think I've got colleagues who are much more productive than I am, but I think I've put out enough at a pretty good clip. I've got a book coming out in the fall.
Yeah.
So, I'm starting another one now. I feel okay about that. Certainly there are others who maybe have a slower pace and don't have a Twitter in the way either.
Yeah. So listen, for all you haters out there who are listening, Kevin Cruz was in the archive today. He was actually doing historical work, right? Drew, you had a question.
Well, it's maybe a good shift because, I kind of want to ask you about how you see your tweeting as supporting you professionally. So do you censor yourself? Do you approach Twitter is say, well, this isn't really on brand for me as a historian, or do you kind of just tweet as yourself? And if it reads as a historian or as a political commentator, who cares? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I get that entirely. And I used to really try to silo. I used to try to only engage as a straightforward, again, kind of by the book, historian. And God, that was boring.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone, again, you can, it was like the History Channel or whatever, and they do a good thing in their own way, but it felt like I was putting on a role. And so, honestly, this is where I think coming into my own as somebody who really engaged on Twitter in, I guess, the summer and fall of 2015, both with the Trump and the Republican presidential primaries and all that stuff going on with the Confederate monuments, as it happened at the same time, right. It became really hard for me to silo off. Yeah. Okay, here I am a political commentator. Here I am a historian. It kind of bled into each other, right? Especially as the past spoke to the present. And so it was really hard for me to keep that down. And then I quickly realized I used to self-censor myself a lot. You can't say that. You can't be jokey there. You can't be sarcastic there. And I quickly realized, you know what? I'm just going to do it. I'm just going to be me. And it was much harder not to be in my own voice than it was just to kind of tweet naturally and just, throw it out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me a little bit. I mean, you've answered this somewhat in some of the answers to the other questions, but what is your, maybe philosophy of tweeting is too sophisticated, but like you mentioned, you tweet during coffee breaks or, how do you know like the time is right to weigh in? Is it just stream of consciousness? Random, you see something and the mind starts going and you start typing. Is there a sort of time of day where, do you spend a block of time sort of, I'm on Twitter now for the next hour or, how does that look in terms of your day, your schedule, your everyday life as a historian? When do you weigh in? When do you not weigh in?
Right.
These kinds of things.
Yeah. Someone asked me, what is your Twitter strategy? And I just looked at him. I didn't know what he was talking about.
Yeah, right.
I didn't know that was a thing that you could have a Twitter strategy, right? Because for me, it really is just half the time it's on my phone.
Yeah.
I'm walking to pick up my kids at the school.
Right.
I'm waiting at the deli counter at the grocery store.
Right.
I'm getting gas. It's coffee breaks, things like that.
Watching the game. Yeah.
The game. Yeah. 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 I do. If you look back, I'm sure during, NFL playoffs and basketball season, it picks up because I'm kind of half watching something on TV, half tweeting at home.
I find that I can't, I just can't watch a football game anymore. I don't know about you, Drew.
Yeah.
I have to have the laptop or the phone with me just to, even if I'm not riffing on the game, I'm riffing on something else. And
I've become an almost chronic multitasker in that regard.
You've caught the disease then too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah.
Let me ask you, I mentioned this before, I kind of foreshadowed this a little bit. Any response to this from, you know, your department chair at Princeton or your colleagues? I mean, I know you're probably friends. I don't know your relationship with Julian Zelizer. I know you're writing a book together. Yeah. He's out there too, although not on Twitter as much, you know, but he's very much a public intellectual. You know, I watch him every Saturday with Fred Whitfield on CNN. What is the administration, the department? I mean, are they kind of fine with this? Has anyone ever said anything to you that you can at least talk about?
No. Yeah. I've never been approached. I think we've got kind of a don't ask, don't tell policy with this. I've heard nothing from anyone in the administration, certainly not from my department chair.
Okay.
My colleagues in the department, many of them are on Twitter too, and are terrific follows.
Yeah.
Will engage with me. There, and again, some have the kind of the, oh, I saw you on Twitter, and it feels like, again, like I was caught, loafing or something
right,
like
exactly.
that. Like, but this is where I think, honestly, where I came into this moment really mattered for me is I came into Twitter as a full professor, right? I had tenure, I had job security. I was fine. I worry that there are really smart, untenured faculty out there or graduate students who have a lot to offer in this field and don't, because there's still a stigma attached to it.
What would your advice be to them? Would you tell them to be careful? We got a grad student sitting in the studio with us, so he's very.
I would. I would say be careful. I mean, you don't want to. I mean, there's a certain way in which I think it's a great thing, especially in terms of connecting with scholars and the general public too, and reporters. God, I've made such great connections with different journalists that I admire and respect, and have been able to talk with them about their work and be sources in their articles.
Right.
That's been fantastic, and that I think has been it wasn't something I planned, but it's been a nice boost. You know, I've got an avenue for, you know, if I want to write an op-ed, I've got, you know, a dozen people I can reach out to immediately now, which I used to not have before Twitter. I used to have to kind of scratch my head of where I'm going to place this. You know, so I think that's a good thing for junior people to develop, to be out there. At the same time, I think I would caution junior people. I'm a little freer out there with my engagement, let's say. I don't have a filter on. In a way that were I still, an assistant professor, I would probably self-censor a little bit more. I would be worried about, saying the wrong thing or offending the wrong person. And it's sad, but that's where we are.
We got a grad student here, Drew, who's dying that follow up on this. Go ahead, Drew.
It's fine. It's interesting you bring that up, just because I've been involved in some job search processes, on campus, up at Lehigh, and they're developing policies about to what extent can job searches engage with the social media presence of their candidates, and advising the job search committees not to, you know, don't engage with their Twitter. That can't be a part of your calculus as you're trying to navigate, and, you know, which brings up some interesting.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, even if they can't engage with you, I mean, who's not going to check it?
Right. Right. But, I mean, we're discussing that, you know, because I've been doing some trainings of doing your first job talk kind of stuff. And this has come up in conversation, and they say, well, you know, we struggle with that because sometimes people say, well, we shouldn't be looking, but then you might already have seen someone's, public engagement.
Right.
So, I mean, it's a thorny issue. It's a complicated issue.
You know, it's funny, Kevin, you were talking about the kind of op-eds and the connections and stuff. I don't know if you've had this or not. I'm sure you have, because you're out there much more than I am and in much better places than I am in terms of your public writing. But I now have like reporters like emailing me with a tweet. Like, you tweeted this. Can you expand on this a little bit more? Or just based on what now, I guess, 280 characters, right? You know, when I first started, you know, I've been at this for, you know, 15, almost 20 years now. You know, when I first started, if a reporter called me up, it was based on like a book I wrote or an article or something substantial, right? So.
Yeah, no, this happens all the time now.
Yeah.
And again, I mean, it's great, but it seems surreal to kind of. To rather than be commenting on the news, to have an observation that sparks an article, right? So I did this a couple of weeks ago, and this is maybe a good example of where teaching Twitter and the media kind of intersect.
Right.
So after the Parkland shooting, there were people online who were claiming that the Parkland students, because they were so poised, because they were so well-spoken, must have been crisis actors. They must have been paid, right? Yeah, well, as that story was going out, I happened to be teaching a section on the Little Rock school desegregation case. Okay. And there was, I just noticed in the documents we had, this is a documents intensive course we do, that in the documents we have, there was an NAACP press release denying that the Little Rock Nine were paid actors.
Wow. Yeah.
So I thought, oh, okay, that's a great connection. If this is the kind of thing that I think people like when they can understand that there's a certain echo of the past and the present. So I tweeted out just, I screenshot a newspaper article, slapped it up there, tweeted it out. Took like 5 minutes, right?
Yeah.
That day, I got contacted by reporters from the New York Times, the Washington Post, Huffington Post, and I had to turn down a couple others who wanted to talk too, just because I've got a day job.
Right.
But that launched three articles, right? Yeah. And one of them, the Huffington Post one, was fantastic. They were all good, but the Huffington Post one went the extra step.
Yeah.
Because she tracked down Minnie Jean Brown, who was one of the Little Rock Nine, who's still living, and interviewed about this. And so drew out, it wasn't just my observation of hear this echo. She went back and found the historical actor and drew her out and got her take on this thing that I'd observed. And she had a much greater insight about it.
That's awesome.
And then that article came out on a Friday, on the day when my students had their papers on Little Rock due. And who did half of them write about? Minnie Jean Brown. So it kind of all came, full circle there. And so when it works like that, it's kind of a really special thing, I think.
Yeah. And it's also amazing too, right? You were talking about when you tweet or whatever, you don't have a philosophy. You wrote that tweet, sort of in the hallway, walk into the men's room or something like that.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And next thing it's in the New York Times.
Because Twitter used to be that I would send it out, and it was like, I started like anyone else. I had zero followers, right?
Right.
And originally it was just people I knew well. And so it was kind of like, like a private Slack chat or whatever. And now I'm realizing, oh, this stuff goes out there, right? And it can really go out there. People will embed tweets. I'm sure you've had this happen.
Yeah.
Embed tweets in news articles, right? As historian so-and-so said. And you're like, oh, right, that's part of the public record now. This thing I beep boop bop out on my phone as I'm walking to my kid's, my son's first grade class.
Right.
That's now something that's out there. Yeah. It's kind of odd.
It is. We don't have much time left. I have one more question for you. You've been in the middle of a lot of, for lack of a better term, tweet storms, right? Where you sort of create this ongoing thread, all these threads and conversations. If I remember correctly, I think read online articles at places that are about that, the subject is you and your Twitter. Your Twitter.
Yeah.
Give me one. What was your most memorable kind of Twitter storm that you sort of instigated, or maybe was the most helpful, or I know you've mentioned some already. But what's the classic? What's the classic Kevin Cruz in your mind sort of Twitter explosion?
Oh. Geez, I don't know. I don't know if I've got any classics. I'll leave that to maybe other people can pick them. One that springs to mind to me, though, that was meaningful to me and was important in the way in which I think kind of Twitter helps me bring my expertise as an historian and my engagement in politics together, was when Jeff Sessions was being floated for attorney general.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of conservative magazines published puff pieces about that basically portrayed Jeff Sessions as a civil rights hero.
Yeah, I remember
that he had defeated the Klan, that he had helped desegregate all these schools. And I knew that wasn't the case.
Yeah.
And it's not that he's, necessarily a villain, but I knew that that portrayal was wrong.
Right.
So I had a thread that kind of picked apart those points, and showed that the case that he'd been attributed with breaking the Klan had entirely been done by a different set of U.S. attorneys.
Right.
That showed that all the schools in his region in southern Alabama had been desegregated before his time. So this couldn't possibly be true. So I put that out there, and I actually got, this is the Weekly Standard and then National Review.
Yeah.
They both issued corrections in their articles.
Yeah.
So I was able to kind of, you know, rather than just kind of sitting at home and reading something that we all do this. Oh, that's wrong.
Yeah. Right.
To actually engage and get them to admit it was wrong, and to tinker with it, to adjust it, to make it, more fact-based, was something that I took some pride in that, he still was confirmed, but I think without that confidence on the right that he was somehow a civil rights hero.
And I imagine that takes a little bit of time to sort of dig up the research and so forth. You know, I mean, how do you, real quick, how do you balance like the kind of instant gratification, right? You want to get something out there and get it out there fast, because that's just the nature of Twitter, right? And then, you must have taken, an hour maybe to kind of dig up, make sure you were right. I mean, you know, it's like a little mini research project, right?
It is. Yeah. And it really, that one in particular, I think took about 2 hours.
Okay.
And I did so because I knew if you're going to say, that this magazine article is wrong,
right?
You'd better be right.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to, as they say, I wanted to bring the receipts, right? And that's something that I think, I always try to do, and I think is really helpful on Twitter for historians in particular to do, is to bring that primary evidence out, right? And so I did screen caps of news articles. I had links to, I think, to court documents, you know, whatever I could do to say, no, look, you've made this broad assertion. Here are the facts, and I'm going to show you with Exhibit A, Exhibit B, Exhibit C, Exhibit D. Yeah. And I had to make sure that that was all lined up. So, yeah, that did take some time. There are a lot of, again, I'd say 95% of my tweets are quick and on the fly. A thread like that really does take work, and it really does have to be approached like a research project because you don't want to then blurt something out and then feel like, I've now got to retract that. That would be the worst.
How you doing? Are you burning out yet? Are you still going strong as a tweeter? Are we still going to see you down the road here or?
I'm doing all right. There's enough in the news to keep me going. Okay. I've had a couple moments where I really thought about dropping out. Honestly, after the election, when the kind of the white supremacist presence online surged for about a week, I thought I don't need this, and I'm going to walk away.
Yeah.
But I really, I kind of realized that there's still in general, there's a thirst for history out there, right? And if we don't fill it as professional historians, someone else will,
absolutely.
Right? And so it can't be, you know, I don't want the public's history knowledge to be a bunch of Bill O'Reilly books, right? Or worse, Bill O'Reilly tweets. I want to do whatever I can. And it sounds corny to feel like it's an obligation or duty, but I do think we've got this responsibility to speak to the public. Because if we don't, other people will, right? And so if we've got the authority and the expertise, I think we should be engaged. So there are days where I feel like I got to walk away from this, but usually it passes, and I come back to it, and I find something that that makes it worthwhile again.
Well, we all appreciate the fact that you're in the thick of this, and if you did walk away, I think you'd get a lot of reaction saying, you know, don't do it, Kevin, you know, come back. We have been talking with Kevin Cruz, professor of history at Princeton, Twitter historian, 84,000 followers on Twitter. Follow him at Kevin M. Cruz. Kevin, thanks so much for your time. I know you're a very busy man. I'm sure you need to get out there and tweet something. So
we'll, it's been half an hour. I'm going into withdrawal here.
That's right. So we'll let you go. Hopefully your next tweet was had a great time on the Way of Improvement Lito podcast. Drew's laughing over here. But again, thanks so much, Kevin. We appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure, guys. Take care.
Have a great day. I tell you, Drew, after listening to Kevin Cruz, I want to go home and tweet.
Yeah, well, you know, I have some catching up to do with my 336 here.
It really is a phenomenal way of kind of reaching people. I mean, Cruz, you know, Cruz is sort of the master of this, you know, and his ability to think on his feet and to think quickly in response to other people's tweets is just amazing to me.
I mean, it's interesting you brought up in the conversation his kind of rise surrounding the debates over Confederate monuments because, you know, he's a 20th century historian. I'm not. With where I am right now in my academic career, the historians I'm most familiar with are those on my comps lists. Yeah. I'm not doing a comps list. And in 20th century America. But I first started following him because some people were retweeting some of his posts and some of his thoughts on Confederate monuments. So, you know, as they say, those things go viral pretty quick.
Yeah, when people ask me who they should follow on Twitter, what historians, he's always the first one that I mentioned, simply because he's really sort of brought this into his professional profile. But he also offers some cautions too, right? This is not for everyone. And it's, you know, those early in their career also need to be careful. I mean, you jumped in on that one part of the interview, right? Thinking about this.
Well, that, you know, and back to your commentary, you know, that's something, even in these departments that are maybe trying to be more proactive in understanding that Twitter is not necessarily your professional voice, it's your personal voice.
Right.
It's still pretty hard to avoid. And, you know, and I'm sure there'll be more discussions about best practices during interview processes for people like me who are, I've never tweeted anything I am embarrassed about, but at the same time, you know, who knows how my 280 characters will be interpreted, because, you know, with that small of a content,
right,
it can sometimes be easy to be misinterpreted.
Yeah. I also thought it was interesting the way he kind of talked about how early on he kind of siloed everything, but then he just kind of, you know, here's my history, right? You know, you asked him that question about your identity, right? Are you a political commentator or a historian? You know, he said, I tried to silo it, but it just didn't work. And, you know, I've always been one, you know, I've written a book about like what historical thinking and why study history. So I often feel a lot of pressure, right? You know, am I tweeting as a historian? Am I tweeting as a Christian? Am I tweeting as a political pundit? You know, and I'm always worried someone's going to call me out and say, well, in your book, you said that, you know. So it's helpful to hear someone like him kind of, and how he navigated this as well.
Well, I think one of the advantages with Twitter as a medium is that it allows us to better engage with people as kind of full people, right? You know, I think about, you know, my long friendship and mentorship with you. You know, it's hard to divorce who you are as a historian from who you are as, for example, a Bruce Springsteen fan, right?
That's,
you know,
right.
And these are things that become through the medium of Twitter kind of unified.
Yeah.
And, you know, I made a joke, I'm either tweeting about something political, something historical, or something having to do with St. Louis baseball. I mean, those are kind of my three modes.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of things to think about here. Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. I know we did. I know we enjoyed having Kevin Cruz with us. He's a very entertaining guest. So thanks for listening. And as always, may your way of improvement lead home.
This has been a production of The Way of Improvement Leads Home, a blog dedicated to reflections at the intersection of American history, religion, politics, and academic life. Visit us at thewayofimprovement.com. The Way of Improvement Leads Home is a member of the Recorded History Podcast Network. Check out the other podcasts on the network by heading over to recordedhistory.net. If you want to support our efforts, please rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice so others may more easily find this podcast. And let's continue the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Follow us at TWOILH Podcast. The podcast was brought to you through the generous support of Gretchen Adams, Kate Logan, Lisa DeGuardi, and Ron Schooler. Also, many thanks to our sponsor, Jennings College Consulting, discovering the right college fit for your future. The podcast was recorded at the High Center Studios of Messiah College. Thanks to Ed Ark for his continued support. Original music is by Overholt. Many thanks to our guest, Kevin Cruz. Our studio producer is Josh Lowry. I've been your producer, Drew Durley-Hermeling, and your host, as always, is John Fia.